Clijsters is off to a great start in her return to Wimbledon. After a four-year absence from the tournament, Clijsters beat Maria Elena Cameron in her opening match, 6-0, 6-3. The eighth-seeded tennis player had been out with a foot injury. Lakers fans may be taking this Monday off or planning on a really long lunch. The crowd in Los Angeles is already growing. Hours before a parade celebrating the Lakers' win over the Boston Celtics in Game 7 at the Staples Center. It's the basketball team's 16th championship title. Organizers have been expecting millions to turn out, but Police Chief Charlie Beck is warning people to stay out of trouble or go to jail. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Child Fund International, providing food, water, and medicine to children in poverty through child sponsorship. Learn more at childfund.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from Rodney G. Peacock, presenting Noontide Festival Month, June 18th through July 11th at Vollinger Auditorium, with music, poetry, and drama, highlighted by a concert by Rodney George Peacock and with his original drama, The Noontide Trilogy, July 2nd through the 11th. Information under events at vollinger.illinois.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. This hour's interview comes from the Focus 580 archives, so that means that we'll not be taking calls. In this part of the program, we'll be talking about the history of Prohibition. Now, Americans, going back to the time of the Puritans, were really always big drinkers. Alcohol was freely available, and it was cheap. By 1830, for example, American adults consumed per capita 7 gallons of pure alcohol every year, and producing intoxicants was a big industry here in the United States. So then the question comes, why is it given that in 1920, America decided to go dry? Our guest for this hour is Daniel Okrent, and we'll be talking about his new book, which is titled Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. It's published by Scribner, and it's just out now. And also is something you can look forward to soon here on this and other public stations is a documentary produced by Ken Burns looking at Prohibition that will feature our guest, Dan Okrent. A little bit more about him. He was the first public editor of the New York Times. He has also been editor at large at Time Incorporated and managing editor of Life magazine. He's the author of 4 previous books, including Great Fortune, which was a finalist for the 2004 Pulitzer Prize in History. As we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that. That's 800-222-9455, and email as well. You can send your questions that way to will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, questions from listeners are welcome. Again, we ask people to be brief so we can keep things moving along, but questions from listeners are welcome. And Mr. Okrent, hello.
How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Let's talk first a little bit, as a matter of background, a little bit about what we know about alcohol consumption in the United States in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Well, as you said in the introduction, David, there was an awful lot of it. The boat that John Winthrop came over to the Massachusetts Bay Colony and had more beer than water in its hold. The drinking, as you said, had reached in 1830 the 7-point-some gallons that you mentioned. Just to translate that, that's in pure alcohol, is about 90-fifths of liquor. That was the consumption per capita for all Americans over the age of 15. And if you consider that there were a lot of people who were, of course, abstainers, those who were drinking really, really drank. One of the reasons why alcoholic beverages were so popular, other than their inherent appeal, is because water was so lousy and dangerous. That, in fact, had a lot to do with why the Pilgrims brought over so much beer. But it also meant that as early as the Revolutionary War, George Washington gave every member of the Continental Army a daily ration of 4 ounces of whiskey. was an interesting way to hydrate yourself while under the stress of battle. This continued through and into the 1830s and 1840s, and only around then did water quality improve so that that could no longer be an excuse. But by then, Americans had either picked up the habit or they had inherited it or brought it with them from the countries they came from, and we were a pretty sodden country. One historian of the period, W.J. Rohrbaugh, wrote, "Americans of that period drank from the crack of dawn until the crack of dawn."
Well, this and given that, then you, of the major things you're really interested in the book, they are how it is that Prohibition changed America, which is really, I think, maybe one of the most interesting parts of this story, which we will talk about, how it and what life was like during Prohibition. But given that, you wonder, well, because alcohol consumption was so common, and you would think that that's something people believe they should have the right to do, why is it that then we amended the Constitution to take the country dry? And of course, the answer to this is it's complicated. There were a number of things that came together to make that happen.
Right. It begins really, interestingly enough, and very much tied to the women's suffrage movement. In the middle of the 19th century, American women had almost no legal rights or property rights, and of course, they did not have the right to vote. A woman in upstate New York by the name of Susan B. Anthony was an active temperance worker. She went to a convention of the Sons of Temperance in 1850 or 1851 and was told that she could not speak because only men were allowed to speak. And in fact, that's what drove Susan Anthony into the suffrage movement, where she and Elizabeth Cady Stanton began their 70-year campaign to amend the Constitution to grant the vote to women. The two movements grew together. The Women's Christian Temperance Union was a very, very powerful, large organization, several hundred thousand members who believed in temperance and wanted prohibition or forms of prohibition at the same time they wanted the vote for women. There was a good reason for it. These women, without their political rights and their property rights, their husbands would go off and get drunk. They would go to the saloon. They would drink away the family money. They would come home and mistreat the family. There was a lot of wife beating, child abuse. There was even something called syphilis of the innocent. Men would go to these saloons, which were often attached to brothels, contract venereal diseases, and then pass along that venereal disease to their wives. In many big cities, the drinking was so extreme that Mondays were almost lost days for many manufacturing and other commercial concerns, because people spent so much time and so much put so much effort into their drinking on their day off, which was Sunday. So there were all sorts of social reasons for it to happen.
And also, just kind of as a going down a little side street on this, I think what's really interesting is that for that reason, because there was this association between temperance and the vote for women, that the alcohol industry was heavily opposed to women's suffrage.
The beer industry, particularly the U.S. Brewers Association, saw that they actually passed a resolution saying that we have to fight women's suffrage wherever and whenever we can. This was really foolish of them, because they became so directly associated with the anti-suffrage campaign that as women began to get the vote, beginning in western states in the 1860s and 1870s and then accelerating up until the Constitutional Amendment, this almost guaranteed their antipathy to the brewing interests and to the distilling interests. So it was one of those cases that I think are not uncommon in American history, where people oppose a movement not realizing that this is a movement that they really don't dare do that. They're going to get on the wrong side of history, and the brewers were in this case.
Yeah.
There are other factors. You know, another one that was really fascinating to me was the movement to create an income tax. Now, what would that have to do with prohibition, you might ask? There was no income tax in the U.S. When one was passed in the 1890s, it was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, and that led to a movement led by Western populists to install an income tax. Now, for the prohibitionists, this was a great, great thing. For until that time, the federal government got as much as 40% of its annual revenue from the excise tax on alcoholic beverages. This goes back to the Whiskey Rebellion of the 1790s and all the way forward. So the prohibitionists realized that they could not really have prohibition unless there was an alternative source of funding for the federal government. And they got behind the income tax movement, and the income tax people in turn got behind the prohibition movement. And in 1913, when the 16th Amendment was enacted, and finally there was an income tax in the U.S., that's when the prohibitionists decided enough of the state-by-state agitation, Now we can get a constitutional amendment.
Yeah, and this association between drinking and taxes comes around again, because I think some people would argue that one of the things that really contributed to the demand to repeal prohibition was that the Depression really reduced federal tax revenues, and someone decided, well, maybe if we bring back alcohol, at least we can tax it.
There's an absolutely direct relationship between the two. In 1929, this market crashes. Incomes go down, the Depression arrives, the federal government is strapped for money to perform its normal functions, much less to do anything to help the country get out of the Depression. And there were people who saw two things in the return of alcoholic beverages. One was the tax revenue that would come back. In fact, Franklin Roosevelt predicted during his campaign in 1932 that simply bringing back beer would bring back $250 million a year to the federal treasury. That would be the modern equivalent of about $4 or $5 billion. The other reason that the Depression led to the end of Prohibition was it was a great jobs program. Before Prohibition, the combined liquor and distilling industries were the fifth largest industry in the country. And then suddenly, bringing back this product and all the people involved in making it and distributing it and retailing it was a fantastic jobs program.
And I guess there are some people who do say that without the Depression, Prohibition probably still would have been repealed, but maybe it would have not have been until sometime maybe in the 40s.
It would have taken a very long time, and I think that one can get an idea of the feeling of the urgency for repeal, that the 36th state, it had to, you know, after passing Congress by two-thirds majorities, the repeal amendment had to be approved by three-quarters of state legislatures. The 36th state that put repeal over the top was Utah. And if we're in a time when Utah is the one that is making it possible to bring back liquor, I think we understand how severe the financial problem was.
Our guest this morning is Daniel Okrent. He's the author of a new book, Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. And it's published here by Scribner. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about the WCTU, and I think probably in a lot of people's minds when they think about prohibition and temperance, that's the organization comes to mind, and I'm sure that people will think about Carrie Nation and have seen photos of someone who looks like she could be your great-great-grandma with the hatchet and know about her going into saloons and breaking up the place.
Well, she was a pretty formidable grandma. I wouldn't want to see your grandma if she looked like Carrie. I think I write in the book the line, Carrie Nation was 6 feet tall, had the biceps of a stevedore, the face of a prison warden, and the persistence of a toothache. She was really something of a sideshow. She was not really affiliated with the WCTU, though she was motivated for the same reasons. But as in the modern age, she had a sense of theater that would attract a lot of press attention. And she was a great photo op to see this woman striding into a saloon in Kansas with a hatchet in her hand. Mm-hmm. And destroying the place. It led to Carrie going on the vaudeville circuit. She became a popular speaker, traveled around the country, and gave away little hatchet pins wherever she went.
The group that was really instrumental in organizing and pushing the prohibition was another organization that came along and from whatever significance WCTU had, I think they really nudged them aside, and that was the Anti-Saloon League.
It's really interesting. This is an organization that is utterly forgotten today, and particularly forgotten was the man who led it, Wayne B. Wheeler, who was an Ohio lawyer, who was passionate in his belief that the country should have prohibition and was the most artful and effective political agitator, I think, and maybe in the nation's history. He was the one who actually created the phrase pressure group, and his group, the ASL, was alone really responsible for putting prohibition into the Constitution. When Wheeler died in 1927, the Washington Post said that when the history of our age is written, his will be the first name mentioned, yet nobody has remembered him. He has utterly disappeared from history. But everyone from Lee Atwater to Karl Rove to James Carville, David Plouffe, what they know about politics, they learn from the playbook created by Wayne Wheeler. Mm.
He apparently was very, very good at identifying where the support was for prohibition and then going there and organizing those people. So I'm sure he thought, well, and I don't have to get the whole country, but if I get these people, then I'm there.
He didn't even need majorities. I mean, his tactic was to find the 10% of people in any particular place who really cared about prohibition. And then if you had the two parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, divided remotely close to one another, he would turn to each candidate and say, what's your position on prohibition? And if you were against prohibition and for godmother and country and everything else wonderful, he would not support you. And if you were for prohibition and also in favor of baby murder, he probably would have supported you. It was the only, we care about one thing only. We do one thing only, Wheeler said. And what they did was take these blocks of 10%, 15%, 6%, whatever it might be, and be the decisive margin in many elections. So the Congress that eventually passed prohibition, passed along to the states, that recommended its passage to the states, did have a two-thirds majority of members voting for prohibition, but they did not represent remotely a majority of the country.
Well, would there be some way to determine, with some level of satisfaction, how many Americans really did want prohibition?
It's hard to say, but I can give you an example that in one election in 1918 in Missouri, the Missouri legislature approved the 18th Amendment by huge majorities of 80%, 75%. Yet at the same time, there was a ballot measure strictly about prohibition on the ballot in Missouri that year, and it lost. So there is no correlation, no visible correlation between the number of people in the populace at large who supported it and those politicians who felt compelled to support it because of Wayne Wheeler's power.
Yeah. We talked about some of the things that went into setting the stage for prohibition. Support from the women's movement and from women who were also working for the vote was part of it. It was an issue for progressives at the time. There also, though, were some other things going on, and one of them was apparently a rather powerful anti-immigrant sentiment, particularly against Germans, against Jews from Eastern Europe, and against the Irish, all people who believed that just part of drinking was just part of life.
Right. I think that in this regard, to a large extent, prohibition was a stand-in issue. I think we could say the same thing today about issues like, say, same-sex marriage. It's not necessarily about same-sex marriage. It's about who's going to control this country, which portion of the country, which faction of the population. And back then, in the Middle West particularly, the white, native-born Methodist and Baptist majorities of the Middle West were losing control of the country to the immigrants who were taking over the cities in large numbers and taking over the political representation and entering Congress. And you saw in a band of cities from Boston to St. Louis and down the Atlantic coast the enormous immigration from Europe that the native-born really hated. And the anti-immigration movements of the teens and 20s hooked up very, very closely with the prohibition movement. We need to stop these people who are corrupting our culture, seemed to be the message.
And another thing here that played a role, that was the First World War. How did that factor in?
Well, you know, the brewers all had such last names as Schlitz and Pabst and Rupert and Schmidt and Anheuser and Busch. They were almost all German. And at a time when anti-German fever had reached hysterical levels, levels of pure hysteria, the prohibitionists, led by Wayne Wheeler, were able to demonize them, say that, you know, all these brewers, they're in the service of the Kaiser. They're sapping the strength and spirit of Americans by making them drunk. They're using up our grains that should be used for this, to bake bread for the starving Belgians. They're using that instead on their terrible beer. So they became the enemy. And it was a Senate hearing that took place in 1918. As the Prohibition Amendment was passing through the state legislatures, that really put it over the top, because the brewers were exposed not just for the fact that they were German, which was something that you could be convicted of simply by your last name, but also because of the effort that they had made underhandedly to promote beer, to oppose women's suffrage, and to do a variety of other things extremely unsavory in a country that was at war.
Yeah, and that was something that later they learned that lesson, because later in the run-up to World War II,
The brewers were the first ones in line at the draft boards, and they were signing up. And you know, the Anheuser-Busch used to have a German eagle on its its logo. Mm-hmm. They replaced it with an American bald eagle. In fact, they had reformed to such a degree that brewery workers, by the middle of World War II, were draft exempt because they were deemed to be necessary to the country's success and spirit.
We're talking this morning again. Let me just very quickly introduce the guest, Daniel Okrent. He's author of a new book that's a history of prohibition. The title of his book is Last Call. It's published by Scribner. Questions, so welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Daniel Okrent was the first public editor of the New York Times. He also served as editor at large at Time Incorporated and has been managing editor of Life magazine. He's authored four previous books, including one titled Great Fortune that was finalist for the 2004 Pulitzer Prize in History. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about the industry and how it saw things going here, because there was this temperance movement in the late 1800s, and before we had the constitutional amendment to the U.S. Constitution, there were several states that were dry, so they must have seen what was looming there on the horizon. How did the liquor industry respond, and did they try to fight the movement?
They fought it state by state. They fought a series of individual battles and lost almost all of them. And they used very underhanded methods. One particular thing that the brewing industry did is that they distributed articles to newspapers with a check, run this article under a false name, making the case for why it's important to keep beer, which they referred to as liquid bread. This was a nourishing food substance in Texas. They knew, or they felt, that they would get support from black voters, and the brewing interest sent out agents to polling places throughout East Texas particularly, armed with three things. The cash to pay the poll tax for a black voter, instructions on how to vote, and a poster of Abraham Lincoln to indicate what side they were on.
We have several callers here. Let's talk with some of the folks who are listening, and we'll take them right in the order that they came in, starting with Champagne and Line 1. Hello.
Hi. I was just wondering, there are a lot of people that have equated prohibition with the war on drugs today, and I'm just wondering if you're seeing a lot of similarities between the two, the lead-up and where we are in the middle of it, and if you foresee what may happen in the future based on what has happened historically.
Well, I do see a couple of very clear parallels. One, for instance, there were three exceptions to the in the Volstead Act, which was the enforcement act that put prohibition into effect, three exceptions that made the manufactured distribution sale of alcoholic beverages legal. And one of those was medicinal alcohol. The American Medical Association in 1922 determined that there were 29 different ailments ranging from cancer and diabetes to my favorite, old age, that could be aided by a prescription for alcoholic beverages. Now, it was a real fraud. What really was going on is that one could walk into nearly any physician's office and buy a prescription for $3 and then trot it over to the pharmacist and for another $3 or $4 buy a pint of liquor every 10 days. This is exactly what's happening in California right now. Yes, there are some real reasons for medical use of marijuana, but anybody who has spent any time walking along Venice Beach in Los Angeles, for instance, where you see people with holding signs saying, "I'm a doctor, get your prescription here," you see exactly the same thing happening. The other thing that I think is related is the tax argument. As we were saying earlier, one of the reasons why alcohol came back was because the government needed tax revenue so badly. And I think that this kind of an argument is we're going to hear it more and more as Americans are more and more resistant to income tax increases. The money to run government is going to have to come from somewhere. And as we know, user taxes of all sorts have become popular. And I think that people will begin to look at the potential tax revenue in marijuana and other recreational drugs and begin to say, look, the stuff is being sold anyway. It's being used anyway. The money from it is only going to Mexican drug cartels. Why shouldn't it go to the federal government?
Well, and one of the things that you talked about was the immigration concerns that were happening during Prohibition. Well, we're having the same kinds of discussions today.
Absolutely.
As it relates to the drugs.
That's right. And, you know, I think that these things move in cycles through American history, and a lot of the things that are going on today that might make one side or another of the political debate not terribly happy, I can point to exact comparisons in Prohibition. And I guess the good news is that this too shall pass. You know, Prohibition looked like it was in the Constitution forever, and it only lasted 14 years.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's continue and talk with someone in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Yes.
I was wondering if you have studied why prohibition was continued in Mississippi into the 60s. At least that's my understanding, is that it remained dry that into the 1960s.
Well, it was dry after a fashion, as in many other states, particularly Kansas, Oklahoma, Utah. There were state laws that limited various forms of alcoholic beverages. And Mississippi, you're right, was the last one. It was until 1968. That they allowed any sale of liquor. But peculiarly, even while it was illegal in Mississippi in the 1950s, it was nonetheless taxed. So it was the sort of thing that it was being sold, but not really being recognized that it was sold because the government needed the revenue. William Faulkner, who liked his liquor, wrote a letter to the Oxford Mississippi newspaper about, you know, let's not change this. It's working. It's illegal, but anybody who wants it can get it.
One follow-up question. Do you think that the fact that it stayed illegal for so long in Mississippi is the reason that they're still bootlegging in a fashion down there, with people making their own alcohol?
I think there are two circumstances that lead people to make their own alcohol. One, you can't buy it legally, or the price has gotten so high that somebody can create it illegally, sell it in the black market for less. And I'm sure that has something to do with it in Mississippi.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And on to another caller. This is Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Yes, hello. And I was going to somewhat echo the first caller's statements, too, in that you have not mentioned anything about the profit motive in the drugs. And it was also there in alcohol originally, too. Very, very rich people got very, very rich running alcohol across the borders. And the same thing's happening today with drugs.
Yeah, I think it is exactly the same. And if I didn't mention, it was only because I thought it was there by implication. The fact is that the people who were selling alcohol were not only making a great deal of money on the alcohol, they weren't paying any tax on the money that they made. Exactly the same thing that's going on with illegal drugs today.
Thank you very much.
I think that really one of the fascinating pieces of this story does indeed have to do with how it is that people got alcohol. And when you think of prohibition, naturally people think about illegal, the way people obtained it illegally and of the involvement of organized crime, which is something we can talk about. But there also were several ways, and you mentioned one of them, that people could actually get it legally. You could get a prescription. You could go down to the pharmacy. You could get it. And in fact, a lot of doctors and a lot of drugstores, they made a lot of money selling alcohol that way.
Well, it's good we're on an Illinois station, because then we can talk about the Walgreens.
Exactly.
There were 20 Walgreens stores in 1920. There were 525 in 1930, after 10 years of prohibition. Now, the Walgreens family publicly always took the position that it was because they invented the milkshake in 1922, and the invention of the milkshake gave these retro rockets that made the chain grow so rapidly. And so hugely. But in fact, Charles Walgreens privately, to his own son, acknowledged that liquor was a very, very big part of their business. And I think liquor is still a big part of Walgreens' business. I know that in many states that you're able to buy liquor in drugstores. Beyond the medical use, the two other exceptions, one was the preservation. It enabled the farmer to preserve his or her fruit juices. That was a euphemism for hard cider or applejack. In the rural districts, the apples were used to create cider, had been since the founding of the Republic or even before. The cider would be fermented and become alcoholic, and people would drink it, and that was okay. And one of the reasons why that was okay is that Wayne Wheeler, the ASL, realized that he needed the support of the farm voters, and taking away their applejack would have been very, very difficult, taking away their hard cider. That led to a huge business in California, where the wineries in 1918, 1919, as prohibition is being enacted, the wine growers are the vineyardists are tearing out their grapevines and replacing them with apricots and plums and other trees. And then suddenly, in the fall of 1920, there's this huge demand for grapes because people who know how to make wine at home or are willing to make wine at home needed the grapes to do it with, and that was perfectly legal. They were preserving their fruit. There were scenes in the San Francisco rail yards during the harvest in 1920 through 1925, 1926, where one guy would buy a freight car full of grapes and sell it to a guy standing next to him, who would sell it to the guy standing next to him. 10,000 freight cars would come into the New York rail terminals every year, every fall, filled with grapes. Billions of pounds of grapes were sold that way, and the price of grapes skyrocketed as a result. The same grapes that were going for $15 a ton in the 1910s, the California grape grower could sell for as much as $300 a ton in 1923. Mm.
And are there still today some big wineries that are in operation and that managed to survive because they were producing sacramental wine?
Yep, you've set me up for the third version. Thank you, Dave. The third exception was sacramental wine, sacramental beverages. This was primarily for to enable Catholics who took communion to continue to get their communion wine, and Jews who used wine at their Sabbath and holiday rites. Enable them to get it as well. And like everything else, it was abused horribly, or wonderfully, depending on your perspective. Georges Delatour, a brilliant man, created a business, Beaulieu Vineyard, still one of the dominant vineyards in the Napa Valley, based on the distribution of altar wines, sacramental wines. He got what's called an ecclesiastical approbation from the Archbishop of Northern California, and a recommendation from the Archbishop to congregations, to dioceses all over the country, that you know this man made good altar wines. By 1922, Delatour was making altar wines in 14 different varietals. You could get Tokay, Cabernet, Riesling. It wasn't exactly what one thinks of when one thinks of the communion ritual at all. What was happening is he was shipping his wines to the rectory of thousands of churches, and some of the wine went directly for the communion, and the rest went directly to the congregation.
Other calls here. Let's talk with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I have two questions. One is, you mentioned in terms of churches and stuff, I don't know if how true, but usually you associate Methodist in terms of, you know, against drinking alcohol, that kind of thing. Was there any, was that as a result of prohibition, or was that in terms of other churches the same way?
Well, no, in fact, excuse me, the Methodists and the Baptists were the organizations, the denominations that led the fight for prohibition.
Oh, okay.
The Anti-Saloon League board was made up entirely of Methodist and Baptist clergymen, which isn't to say that some of them didn't do some drinking in secret, but publicly the position was no drinking.
Okay, the next one has to do with, well, we certainly know that alcohol today, especially when it comes down to alcoholism, you know, these social problems, and I don't know whether anyone's ever estimated what it really cost us, you know, in terms of recovery, all that kind of stuff, and the family and all that. What about the cost of prohibition in terms of, you know, the gangsters, the crime, the thing? I mean, there certainly must have been a huge rise in this kind of things during that period, right?
Well, in fact, Prohibition was responsible for the creation of the National Crime Syndicate. Until Prohibition, crime was localized. If you take in Chicago, for instance, the first and second wards on the south side, a district called the Levee, that was the criminal district in Illinois, in Chicago, run by a couple of politicians, of course. It was being in Illinois. It was gambling, it was prostitution, it was drugs, and that was all a nice local business in which some people made a lot of illegal money. But when you begin to have huge quantities of goods that have to be shipped from one place to another, when you need to move barrels of beer and cases of liquor, you need somebody at the other end. So a lot of the liquor in Chicago, for instance, came via Detroit. It came from Canada, exported to Detroit illegally, smuggled into Detroit, and the gang in Detroit, the Purple Gang, made an alliance with the Chicago gangs. We're going to ship our drugs to you, our liquor to you. And this happened all over the country, so that in 1929, there was a meeting at the President Hotel in Atlantic City where the heads of the crime syndicates from seven cities got together, and they made a national cartel. And they fixed prices, and they defined territories, and created the nationwide mob that stayed with us for decades.
Thank you.
All right. Has anybody tried to estimate how much money went into the pockets of police officers and other public employees in form of bribes to get them to look the other way?
No one can count that high. It's a staggering number. My favorite story relating to that has to do with a very famous bootlegger of the era named George Remus, who was bringing in personally as much as $30 million a year early in Prohibition. He was originally from Chicago, but he operated out of Cincinnati because Cincinnati was within 300 miles of 80% of the liquor stored and bond in the U.S. And when he finally failed and was arrested, he said that, you know, there were some people who can control the wheat market and some who control the silver market. I tried to corner the graft market, but no one has enough money to corner the graft market, and he finally lost out.
So just to, kind of to round this point out, are there people who would be prepared to argue that if prohibition had never been, we wouldn't have organized crime as we have come to know it?
I don't know whether one can go that far. Like, there could have been other things that would have led to the creation of the National Syndicate, but this certainly accelerated it. You know, I think that the opportunity to make money is a very arresting incentive for a lot of people, and at that time there was so much money to be made in illegal liquor that the criminals across the country were incented to do something about it. Mm.
Our guest in this hour focused, Daniel Okrent, and he is the author of a new book that looks at the history of prohibition. The title of his book is Last Call. It's just out now. It's published by Scribner. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. We talked a little bit here about one major area of interest that you deal with in the book, and that is, well, what was life like during Prohibition? And we talked a little bit about where people got their alcohol legally and illegally. Another really interesting area that you look at is ways in which Prohibition changed American life. And in some very interesting ways, it had an effect on relations between men and women and on what people considered to be nightlife and what they did for fun. And all of that, really, we can chalk up to Prohibition.
Yeah. If you take a look at what drinking, public drinking, was pre-Prohibition, the wealthy did drink. They would drink together, men and women, in hotel restaurants. But for most Americans, the place where one would get one's alcoholic kick was in a saloon, and the saloon was a male-only institution, and men would go there to drink, to enjoy each other's fellowship, to, in some places, to, you know, find jobs. Immigrants would even find beds to stay in the saloon. The saloon was the center of this intense male culture. When along comes Prohibition, and the saloon is officially outlawed and becomes a place that is existing outside of convention, then conventions break down as well. And soon women were stepping into them because it was kind of an exciting thing to do this illegal thing. And if there were women coming into the bars, then, well, you had to have table service because you couldn't all belly up to the bar. That wasn't quite proper. And if you have men and women sitting at tables, well, maybe entertainment. There had never been dance bands in bars, jazz bands in bars, any kind of music in bars until Prohibition. The outlaw music, jazz, came in as well. Women in bars, they needed to go to the bathroom like the men did, but there were no women's rooms in the bar. So, you know, these were facilities that had been only male before. So the saloon owners, now speakeasy owners, they had to find something to do. So they would to do about this problem. So they would find a corner underneath a stairwell or behind a bar or in a closet and put in a toilet and a sink and a door for the women. That was called the powder room. That's the absolute origin of both the phrase and the phenomenon that comes about then. Another thing was the cocktail party. The literary critic Malcolm Cowley goes to Paris in 1920, comes home 3 years later, and he's shocked by this event that he gets invited to, and now on a regular basis he's going every weekend to a cocktail party, people getting together for the sole purpose, men and women, to drink at somebody's house. Never existed before Prohibition.
Yeah. So the cocktail party and the nightclub as we know it were really born because of Prohibition.
The direct consequence of Prohibition. Yeah.
It seems that in some big cities, I'm sure that there were stunning numbers of speakeasies. In New York, apparently, somebody has estimated there were, I don't know, 30,000?
32,000. The police commissioner in New York, he estimated there were 32,000 speakeasies in New York in 1929. Now, you have to remember, a speakeasy could be a very elaborate, fancy place like the 21 Club, which is still there. It could also be just a table with a bottle and two chairs next to it. But there were 32,000 places, he said, where you could buy liquor.
Yeah, I've seen one figure I've seen for Chicago is somebody has decided there were 10,000. And I was interested to note that there apparently are a number of bars in business today that claim, whether that's true or not, that claim to have been speakeasies.
Yeah, that's fairly, it's become a trend in the last couple of years. You see this in a lot of cities, the return of what some people call Prohibition chic. Let's put a peephole in the door, a no sign outside, unlisted telephone number. You kind of enter from the rear. what's amusing to me about that is that that was perhaps the style of which people drank in speakeasies in the first few years of Prohibition. But by the middle of the 1920s in the big cities, if you wanted to drink, you walked in the front door and everybody knew it was a speakeasy. The cop on the beat was being bribed, and there was no problem at all. So we may like the idea of having to look through the peephole and say the password, but really what you needed to do, for instance, to get a drink in Detroit, according to Malcolm Bingay, who was the editor of the Detroit Free Press, I'm not going to get his words exactly right, he said, but to get a drink in Detroit, he said, you need to walk into a bar and shout really loudly so your voice can be heard over the other voices by the bartender who's 10 feet away from you.
Well, I still like the fact that we're still so attached to the to the people. It makes me think of that routine in that Marx Brothers movie, you know, where there's a password, and so the business between Groucho and Chico is all about what is the password.
Yeah, exactly.
And that it's the truth of the matter was it got to the point where the speakeasies were operating very openly, and it was almost to the point where, you know, there was a sign and you just walked in.
Right, and that was particularly true. The cities, the wettest cities in the country were Boston, New York, Baltimore, New Orleans, San Francisco, Detroit, and Chicago. And what they all had in common, except for Chicago, was that they were either on the Canadian border, Detroit, or they were on the coast, so that liquor could come in very, very easily. It was much tougher if you lived in Wichita to get liquor. And then what they all had in common, including Chicago, was very large immigrant populations, very large Catholic populations, Eastern European, Irish, Italian, people who opposed Prohibition and were going to have their wine, their beer, or their whiskey, the law be damned.
Yeah, maybe just one other quick thing you mentioned. We could mention one of the things that we have because of Prohibition is we have brand names.
That's right.
Alcohol.
One of the things, instead of having to say a password, you had to say a brand name in some bars. What happened? Before 1920, people would walk into a bar, into a saloon. A man would walk into a saloon and say, give me a shot of whiskey, a shot of rye, whatever it might be. This continues in the early years of Prohibition, but people are beginning to make very questionable rye or whiskey or gin. They were taking industrial alcohol, alcohol that was legal for industrial purposes, for everything from aftershave to making felt hats and explosives, and then renaturing it, taking out the poisons that were put into it by the government, and bottling it, usually with coloring added. Prune juice was a common colorant, or creosote was added to things, to some grain whiskey, simply to give it a smoky flavor so they could be passed off as scotch. So, you know, this was very squirrely stuff, and it was very dangerous to drink. So people got confident, wanted to be confident they were drinking safely, and they'd say, not give me a scotch, but give me a Dewar's, give me a Cutty Sark. Call brands are born in Prohibition.
Mm. Other callers here. Well, I'll talk next with someone in Peoria. Line 4 right here. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Hey, the guest has mentioned Cincinnati is a big distiller, but in Peoria, all the big old houses are former distillers. I don't know. Could he comment on Peoria as a...
Yeah, Peoria was the second largest, for a city on its own. It was second only to Louisville in the amount of whiskey that was created there. And in fact, at the end of Prohibition, a couple of the large Canadian liquor firms bought the Peoria distilleries because they could get right back into business instantly in the legal business that was available in the U.S.
Some of the one of the things that we know that happened because of Prohibition is a lot of smaller producers, I'm sure wineries and also smaller brewers, and there would have been a time when every city had probably multiple small brewers. Those people, they just went out of business. The bigger ones, they managed to hang on by finding something else to do so they could keep their factories operating and keep their people employed, so that then they were, when Prohibition was repealed, they were ready to go.
Yeah, they were the ones that were left. And during the Prohibition years, they made near beers, which weren't such a great hit, but they also made ice. They made ice cream. They distributed malt syrup, which was legal, so people could make beer at home. Malt syrup was not alcoholic. It's what you did with it after the fact. And so at the end of Prohibition, you have about one-tenth the number of breweries that there had been before Prohibition, for exactly the reasons that you cited. It was possible for an Anheuser-Busch, a huge vertical company that did everything. They even designed their own refrigerated cars and sold them to the meat packers it was easier for them to stay in business than for the small operation that used to be in every neighborhood and every city in the country.
Yeah, I guess Prohibition was really good for the yeast business.
Excellent for the yeast business. Excellent also for the sugar business. In fact, in Rockford, Illinois, there was one operation that was getting 2 carloads of corn sugar every week, and they weren't making, you know, flavored soda pop out of it. They were doing it. They were distilling it. They were turning it into whiskey.
Well, we have maybe about 5 minutes here. You can talk about how it is that this all came apart. We did earlier talk about the fact that tax revenues were down during the Depression, so that some people said, well, one of the things that we can do is we bring back alcohol, we'll tax that, and that will bring some more money into the government's coffers. There were people, and there was actually a movement to repeal Prohibition. What really drove that?
Well, first of all, it was financed by the DuPont family. The three DuPont brothers of that generation really put up most of the money for it, and a number of their industrialist friends. And I quote in the book, in Last Call, from some incredible correspondence, letters from Pierre DuPont to his brother Lamotte, saying, if only we can get rid of this damnable prohibition, we'll also be able to get rid of this damnable income tax. They didn't simply want prohibition to come back because the government needed money. They were hoping they wanted prohibition to end because the government needed money. They wanted prohibition to end so they wouldn't have to fund government themselves from their income taxes. So that they were the kind of the secret powers behind the repeal movement. But there were, you know, by then it had so clearly failed, and the prohibitionists had so overreached with efforts to impose stiffer and stiffer penalties. The respect for law and order had plummeted, because here was a series of laws, something in the Constitution being ignored on a minute-by-minute basis across the country, that there was popular support behind the tax-driven arguments that were offered by the DuPonts and others.
And when Prohibition was repealed, alcohol came back, the taxes came back. They didn't get rid of the income tax.
Well, in fact, income taxes did go down, but not for the DuPonts. This was 1933 in the first Roosevelt administration, and income taxes for most Americans went down about 20%. For wealthy Americans, they stayed high, and those very same DuPonts and their allies who had supported Roosevelt because he was pro-repeal, among other reasons, turned against him and founded the virulently anti-Roosevelt American Liberty League.
Well, at least they could have a drink. Well, I suppose they could have before.
Yep.
If you had money, you probably always
could. Anybody
could. Yeah, anybody could. Well, that's another interesting feature of how it is that changed American life that you talk about, is that, well, first of all, we know that Prohibition didn't stop people from drinking. They still found ways to drink. But that when it came back and drinking became legal again, there actually were restrictions that certainly hadn't existed during the time of Prohibition.
It's the strongest, to me, the most remarkable irony about this whole period, is that it became harder to get a drink after repeal than it had been during Prohibition. During Prohibition, there in the cities, anybody who wanted a drink could get one any day of the week, any time of the day. Anybody of any age, virtually, could walk into a speakeasy and get a drink. Afterward, when you put in all these codes and laws of age limits and can't sell on Sunday and closing hours and can't be near a church, can't be near a school, suddenly there's a superstructure of laws and regulations that anyone who's selling liquor with a license has to follow, or he's going to lose his license. And as a result, the state became much more active in making sure that the law was being obeyed than it had been in the late years of Prohibition.
So it was the case that drinking in America was different even after Prohibition was repealed?
We didn't get back to the pre-Prohibition level of per capita drinking until the 1970s. So it took 40 years. And even since the 1970s, it's gone down somewhat. But the effect of the post-Prohibition liquor laws really kept liquor consumption, beer consumption, wine consumption down.
So, and I'm sure that whenever you talk about this, you get questions, as we did earlier. People said, well, what are the lessons to be learned? What's the parallels between the attempt to ban alcohol and the attempt to ban other kinds of intoxicating substances? Do you think that are, in fact, some lessons that we can learn from going back and looking at this time?
The number one lesson is that you can't control human appetites, that if people want something, particularly something that doesn't obviously hurt somebody else, even though it could hurt somebody else, they're going to get it, whether we have laws against it or not. And I think this has been proven true throughout the history of the country and continues to be proven today. Marijuana and other drugs have been illegal for many, 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 many decades, and many, many, many people ignore that prescription. You can't stop people from doing what they're going to do. That has to be lesson number one. The other one is this control point about the regulations that come with legalization. I don't know whether there's one in Illinois, but very few states have a law against driving while stoned. But I guarantee you, if marijuana were legal, that law would be put into place. So would age limits, so would limits on who could sell, where it could be sold, and so on.
Well, we do have a law that talks about driving while intoxicated, or maybe now we call it driving under the influence, and clearly alcohol is probably the number one thing. I would think that it also there has to be something in the law about other kinds of mind-altering substances.
Yes, but if you're stopped, it's a breathalyzer.
Yeah, true enough.
And the breathalyzer is not going to tell you whether you've been smoking marijuana.
Yeah. For those people who were really heavily invested in prohibition and in the move to get that constitutional amendment, when prohibition was repealed, how did people feel? And was that something that was crushing for them personally?
It was, and I think particularly one of the most admirable of the prohibitionists was a senator from Texas named Morris Shepherd, who was a wonderful public servant. He was actually dry himself, unlike a lot of the prohibitionists who were secret drinkers. And he believed that this was good for the country. And he gave a speech on the anniversary of on January 16th, the anniversary of the Prohibition Amendment, every year in the Senate until his death, asking for it to come back. We have to bring this back. We have to bring this back if we're going to be a strong country. He despaired, as did many others who cared earnestly and seriously about the issue. The problem is that there were many people who were extremely cynical about it, and I think their despair was of a different color.
Well, that's about where we're going to have to finish. Just mention one more time, there is a documentary coming. Ken Burns has made. Do you know when that's
going to be? Yeah, it'll be in 2011.
In 2011, so that'll be next year. And so you will be in this?
I am in it a great deal. But now you've heard me talk, say everything that I have to say about it. Maybe you don't need to watch
it. So we don't need to watch it. No.
You should read the book, because the book is even more interesting.
There really is a tremendous amount of interesting material here. And I think not, the political machinations that resulted in passage. But I think, as I said, the parts that, to me, I think that really are so fascinating are how the impact on American life, on social relations, on what we think involves having a good time, that all of that really was changed by prohibition.
I think so.
Well, the book, again, is titled Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition by our guest Daniel Okrent. His last name spelled O-K-R-E-N-T, if you are looking for the book, published by Scribner. And Mr. Okrent, thanks very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for listening.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of items either made from recycled materials or are recyclable, like shopping bags, bag clips, and key tags. Information on their Go Green catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They're more than just trophies.
WILL is listener-supported radio, so you hear more program per hour. But right now, we need your help to maintain the non-commercial nature of our program service. We're still short of our $2.1 million fundraising goal. Your support before June 30th will ensure the quality and diversity of the programs you hear. Give online at willpledge.org. Thank you.